Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome into another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, a discussion between key stakeholders on the ground level of the extraordinary fight against homelessness in Rhode Island, the Reverend Jack Jones of the Matthewson Street Church, and House of Hope's Megan Smith. In recent times, Providence, Rhode Island has consistently been noted for widespread economic disparity. While somewhat skewed by the presence of a typically short-staying and isolated elite class of students and their associates, Providence possesses a visible and urgent homelessness challenge that requires a multidimensional approach to begin solving. At the heart of this fight are several key activists and organizations, such as Reverend Jones and Ms. Smith, who are each uniquely situated to offer practical ideas for addressing the problem of homelessness in Rhode Island. And look, this is obviously not breaking news that there's a homelessness crisis not only in Rhode Island, but throughout the United States. Economic disparity factors into just about every aspect of policymaking today. And how to combat that, that's one of the major points of disagreement out there. When it comes to homelessness, there's a lot of numbers, there's a lot of data that's been presented nationally and also here in Rhode Island. Other than anecdotal evidence that you can gather yourself, there's really no better way to assess it than going straight to the source, talking to people who are experiencing homelessness, and talking to those people who are right on the ground every day combating this crisis. And that's exactly what we have for you here, a conversation with two key stakeholders in the fight against homelessness in Rhode Island, House of Hope's Meg Smith, and giving us a little background on his journey to where he is today at the Matthewson Street Church, the Reverend Jack Jones.
When I was in college at the College of Worcester in Ohio, I dropped out of school after reading a book by Dorothy Day called The Long Loneliness. And I wanted to commit myself to working with the homeless. And I went to work on the near west side of Cleveland at a drop-in center there, and also worked in meal sites and had wonderful mentors, Father Bagan in Cleveland. And so it's been a deep passion for a long time. I got talked into going back to school. In fact, I got talked into doing my research on the homelessness issue at the time. This was in the early 80s when the first wave of the Reagan budget cuts and those kinds of things were happening. And so there's a lot of interest in homelessness. And so my professors talked me into doing it for course credit, and I wrote essays and papers and read a ton of books. And then later, while I was in seminary, I worked at a church that was called the Church of All Nations in Boston. It's no longer with us, but it had been a very influential church that founded Goodwill Industries. And they had a meal site, and I helped coordinate a decision to have an overnight shelter there. And that process in that church about making that decision was another kind of major project. Then later I moved to Rhode Island here and took a position in Kingston, and I started volunteering at Amos House. And I met a lot of the wonderful cohort of people there at the time, Jim Tell, and Phil, and others. And then kind of fast forward a while, I was a chaplain at CCRI and would work with homeless students at the community college. And I also was hired, was one of the initial staff people for a program called HELP, the Homeless Ecumenical Leadership Program. And they sent me to Berkeley to study for 8 weeks about how to work with dual-diagnosed chronically homeless people on the street. And so I led a chaplaincy program, and I was with that program for about a year. But a lot of those, that was 20 years ago, and a lot of what I was studying in Berkeley and working with that year is what we now call housing first, the idea that it's an actual kind of medicine to have an apartment where you can be safe and secure, that it helps your recovery efforts, working with mental illness, and that it just gives you peace of mind no matter where you've been. Perhaps the trauma of just being on the street, it helps you deal with that trauma. So I did that kind of a decade and a half before its time. And so I encountered a lot of frustration in that ministry. And then later on, I participated in a demonstration with three other Methodist pastors. I happen to be a United Church of Christ pastor. I still am. But I was involved in this Methodist group that got arrested at the State House. And that action helped trigger a lot of other actions. It came at the time when the Neighborhood Opportunities Grant Program, which is, it was at the time $5 million that they would spend every year on affordable housing. And it was, the governor was proposing cutting it. And so we had that demonstration at the State House, and it sparked a lot of activity. There were waves and waves of other arrests that happened after that, and then large demonstrations. And so for a while, I was just very caught up in kind of the advocacy end of things. Then I landed at Matthewson Street Church. I landed there. I was in between jobs, and frankly, I was at a point in my life where I was very depressed. I'd been going through a divorce, et cetera. And I was invited to one of the book groups there that had been suggested by the district superintendent about a church in Texas that started out with 20 people and ended up being a very active, vital church, but it was mostly homeless and formerly homeless people in that church. And I just said out loud in the coffee hour, I said, well, that's what I've always wanted to do, which it was, you know. And a woman who's a professor of social work, who's a member of the church, she said, well, I'll give you $500 to start it. And my theology of call is something where your talents might meet the needs in the world, and something you've always wanted to do, as well as somebody calls you to do it. Besides God. And so I took that kind of offer of the $500 as like a calling. And so I ended up starting the Friendship Prayer Breakfast at Matthewson Street Church. And I say I started it. I got it going, and it would have totally failed, but Scott Budnick came along. And the two of us have worked very well together. And he's a phenomenal leader in that church and leader in the community, and it was just an amazing, wonderful epiphany in my life, and it was what I always wanted to do, and it helped lift me out of depression. And we serve a meal of 250 to 350 people, 600 any given month, and we do it as a worship meal. That church had already had a Friday night meal for decades, wonderful meal with Liz McGrath and others. And we wanted to do something so that people wouldn't feel like they're just kind of coming and going. You know, there's a lot of places that serve meal sites. And it's something people do to be nice. And they say, we're serving our guests. And having people be esteemed as guests is wonderful. But we kind of wanted to take it in a different way and say, well, you're not a come-and-go guest. You're one of us. You know, consider yourself at home. And like the Oliver song, consider yourself part of the family. And so we called it the Friendship Prayer Breakfast, and we have as a major objective to become friends. So we are conscientious not to set a boundary and say, you folks over here behind this line, and we're over here, and we're the servers, and you're the served. But we've tried to blur those boundaries and say, we are all in this together, and be very deliberate about friendships. And the last piece of that is that we're just started this month spinning off basically like our housing ministry. We've been doing a lot of informal housing, finding apartments for people just as friends. And even now letting people couch surf and all those kinds of things. And I had built an attached dwelling unit, an in-law apartment in my home, you know, a separate entrance, separate bathroom and separate kitchen. And now we're moving close to having two of those in my home. And so our ministry is to form support teams of faith, family, and friends that will work cooperatively with, be supervised by a social worker or a chaplain. And that's the support part, wraparound support part of supportive housing. And we have this wonderful network and pool of volunteers from the church, from these thousands of people that over the years that have, some have passed through and gotten apartments, et cetera. And they're plumbers, carpenters, electricians, and they are willing, if someone is willing to say, Shine, it's called Shine, can use this bedroom or this basement or this attic or whatever it might be, we're willing to go in there and create an in-law apartment out of that bedroom, make it a separate entrance and make it a separate kitchen, a separate bathroom. And in exchange for us doing that reconstruction work, they have to agree to make it one-third of that person's income, and it has to be a very low-income person. So we're chasing the Holy Grail, you know, that we, you know, that very affordable apartment that the culture at large just hasn't figured out how to create enough of.
Yeah, that's something that is absolutely present throughout Rhode Island, certainly in Providence, a microcosm of that.
Yeah, all over,
know,
the country.
Really anywhere at this point, for sure. Let's talk about House of Hope. Let's talk about your journey. Where did that begin, and how did you land at House of Hope? Now I know you're in school. You're all in as well on this broad project here. Tell us about that.
Yes, hearing you speak, it's reminiscent in some ways of my own trajectory through this work, in that it started sort of by fluke when I was an undergraduate. I went to school here in Providence, and by complete coincidence, when I was a freshman, one of my dorm mates, we lived in the dorm that was far from the center of campus, one of my dorm mates said, I really want to go to this HOPE meeting, this meeting of the student group that works on housing and homelessness issues, but I don't want to walk alone at night. Will you come with me? And I said, sure. I'd never been involved in issues of homelessness before, but I was curious, and I went. And for my friend, it was no big thing, but I was immediately hooked. My first action with HOPE was attempting unsuccessfully, as it turned out, to prevent the demolition of the Welcome Arnold shelter, which was at the time the largest shelter in the state. And I still remember that first encounter because it was the first time I'd had the opportunity to stand shoulder to shoulder with folks who were experiencing homelessness. And it was the most revelatory experience of my life. I immediately fell in love with the folks and the community. This is true to this day, I've never met a more amazing, wonderful, resilient, creative, funny, real, honest, beautiful group of people. That was 13 years ago. And for the last 13 years, my trajectory has been similarly to what you said. You said theology of call. I love that phrase. And
yeah, me too. I love that.
I can't claim that phrase, but I can claim its sentiment of, how do I bring my skills and my privilege and my everything that I have, how do I bring that into the service and in solidarity with folks who are experiencing homelessness? And for me, that has led me through a few rounds of school. I'm a social worker, graduated from RIC the first time around, and now I'm back at BU for a second round. But throughout that time, I have been a street outreach worker. So I work with the House of Hope Outreach Program, formerly as an employee and currently as a volunteer, now that I'm back in school. Our team works with folks who are experiencing street homelessness, mainly in the Providence area, but statewide. And part of our work is the direct work of supporting folks in connecting with services. And even a bigger part of our work is advocating for those services to be responsive to the needs of folks who experience homelessness. Our housing system is one of the many fundamentally broken systems that contribute to people becoming and staying homeless for years and years and years. And then the biggest part of our work is being present in the lives of folks who are marginalized or excluded in so many ways. And I think the biggest thing that we bring to the table is our bearing witness and is using what we hear and honoring it as the realest of truths, and then figuring out how do we responsibly work in collaboration with this community to act upon it, whether that be helping an individual to appeal a housing denial or access a public benefit, or whether it's screaming at the state house or advocating for a resource that doesn't otherwise exist in our system.
Yeah, and the one thing that jumps out about, well, one of many things that jumps out about both of your works is the practicality of it. You know, it's not so esoterical. You're solving big problems, you know, you're attempting to solve the entire big problem, but you're chipping away at it on a case-by-case basis. No, you can't build an in-law apartment for every person who's homeless, but you're doing what you can to chip away at that problem. I mean, is that an approach that's valid, you know, when we face such a, I think it is, I think that's the way to do it, you know, be realistic as best you can, one life at a time improved, you know, is that sort of your mantra on this thing?
Well, yeah, with the breakfast, we'd say, making friends one meal at a time. That was on the cover of our brochure and all that. But I believe in kind of trying to be as creative as you can to set a template that might be imitated so that you can kind of make the most impact you can on a problem. So Shine is in some ways an experiment, but I think we take a lot of inspirations from Habitat for Humanity, which I've done a lot of volunteering with, and I love Habitat. But when my daughter was an intern with Habitat, we discussed a lot that it doesn't really serve the homeless population. It's for a different kind of set of people. But that basic idea of the revolving loan fund, volunteer labor, volunteer supplies, offered goods, That's a model I'm trying to adapt to the issue of homelessness. And so we're building up the revolving loan fund and networking with carpenters and contractors that can leave off, you know, their leftover wood after they're done with their project, and doing that kind of thing. And what I love about Habitat is that because of the revolving loan fund, it just, once you just kind of get the ball rolling, it keeps rolling. There's the funds available for the next project and the next project and the next project as the loans get repaid. So, I think a lot of times when it's kind of sad in a way, but optimistic in our context is a lot of problems with the poor get solved when you can build a common cause between, you know, the middle class or the lower middle class and the poor. And so we've artificially banned a heck of a lot of housing stock through snob zoning, single occupancy zoning. And we've said, even if you're poor and about to be foreclosed on, you cannot rent out a room because your neighborhood says you're not zoned for that. And we think we can empower people who are facing foreclosure or who don't have money for pharmaceuticals at the end of the month or, you know, any of their needs, clothing, any transportation, anything, because they're paying all their money towards their mortgage or whatever it is. And this way we could, if they provide a room and we provide the financing and materials, et cetera, to make that room an apartment, even if it's one-third of a person's income, say they have a disability income of $800 to $1,000, then the rent would be $200 to $300. And that $200 to $300 is the family's pharmaceuticals, and it's their clothing and their transportation and some things that take the edge off for them so they don't have to go to the food bank and that kind of thing. So financing to people who need to create in-law apartments the most to be able to survive, it's a win-win between two groups, and we can be kind of a mediator recruiting those people, being aware of those people, and basically any pastor or, you know, imam or rabbi or humanitarian that has like a food bank, they know exactly who has a home and who runs out of money for food, because that's who shows up at the food bank at the end of the month. So they could just pass out brochures about Shine and recruit even a small percentage of people that are in that pool. There's 70% of households have empty bedrooms, and 30 to 40%, depending on the neighborhood, are house burdened. They're the ones that don't have the money at the end of the month. So if we could get those demographics together, we could really solve a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, now we're getting into the
I don't know about solving, but we could put a dent in it.
Well, for sure. I mean, we're getting into the teeth of specifics. I remember it was about, I guess it was last April, I did an episode, one of my first episodes from the field, the day Shower to Empower was launched. That's an initiative that House of Hope is at least a partner on, correct? Yeah. So what sort of, you know, really working on practical policies that need to be changed, or really chipping away at that idea of, hey, you know what, the lower middle class, poor class, if you will, can forge an alliance here for everyone's benefit. What, anything going on your end about in that department, if you will?
Yeah, I think sort of I'll go meta and then I'll shrink in. Yeah. Going back to the point about sort of the value of doing both the case and the cause simultaneously, I definitely see those as two halves of the same coin, not as two distinct efforts. Mm-hmm. I think that we cannot have informed policy if we do not start from the lived experience of folks who are facing the issue about which we're trying to form policy. So around homelessness, I mean, this is, I think, why Housing First has been such a recent development. When you said you found it to be true 15 years ago, 15 years before it hit the mainstream. And I think that's because you were proximate with people who are living in poverty.
Right, yeah.
And I think that we, as a society, speaking of solidarity, speaking of you know, a mutual benefit amongst and between classes, I think that we as a country are shy about talking about class, social class.
We don't even acknowledge it.
And we don't, there's not mechanisms for folks who are in other social strata to really interact with people who experience homelessness. And I think that's why all of these really negative stereotypes propagate. So I think anything that we can do to create those connections and those real connections, right? Whether that be by sharing a home, or some of what we do is getting folks out on outreach. So folks have the opportunity to speak with people who are experiencing homelessness on their turf and on their terms, and to really understand the narratives of their lives. And I think that doing so really breaks down a lot of the really ugly stereotypes that exist around people who experience homelessness, and then that impact people's willingness to rent or willingness to disengage with the issue or with the people.
No, I completely agree. Yeah, you know, plenty of times, you know, if I tell someone, oh, where do you guys live now? Oh, we live in Elmwood. Oh, man, like, you know, Broad Street's a war zone. You can't, you know, someone's going to break your window or something like that. You know, some guy's going to come up and mug you in the middle of the night or whatever. I mean, it's remarkable, you know, just the, like you say, the distance from reality that a lot of people have right here that live in Providence. You know, how can we bridge that gap? I know we have a mayor who definitely is aware of this issue, certainly appointing former Representative Regenberg. Certainly they have their eyes on affordable housing as part of a broader plan that includes pre-K and I think just sort of planting stronger seeds. But, you know, we've got the giving meters. We've got some sort of surface level stuff happening, if you will. Everything seems like it's heading in the right direction. But beneath the surface, each of you have a perspective that most people do not have. I'll start with you, Meg. Is the city doing enough right now to support homelessness? To support homelessness, you know, programs and just the practical one-on-one getting people into a better position?
Yeah. So, no. No, they're not. But that's not unique to them, right? I think that as a society, we're not doing enough. As a state government, we're not doing enough. As any level of government, we're not doing enough, right? And we're not doing enough outside of government. So yeah, I want to hold the city's feet to the fire, but I don't want to hold their feet exclusively to the fire. I think that the issue of housing, it has to be attacked from so many angles at the same time. So there's the role of organic community, which is so critical and so under-respected, right? Organizations like Shine or initiatives like Shine are completely disregarded in this conversation, and I think that's a crime. And then there's also the more formal means of housing support. So, for example, taking a really critical look at the tenant selection plans of affordable housing providers in the city and looking at how those systematically discriminate against people who are homeless by proxy of criminal record or credit history or landlord history, really considering rent control and other really assertive means to make sure rents are affordable, looking at downtown development and how many of those big fancy buildings going up are going to include units, not even necessarily that are affordable in and of themselves for lower income people, but that are eligible for Section 8 vouchers, housing choice vouchers, so that folks, those few folks who are lucky enough to wait on those lists for years and get those vouchers can find units with which to use them in the communities of their choosing. Looking at the redevelopment of areas such as Barbara Jordan off of near Amos House off of Broad Street, and really involving all stakeholders in that community, including and especially the unhoused members of those community and those redevelopment initiatives. So I don't doubt that there are folks in the city government who are really interested in this issue. I think, though, that there are a ton more ways that they can deeply engage with this issue, and starting again from the perspective of the people who are facing homelessness or housing insecurity in the city, and then sort of branching out in all of these many directions from there.
Reverend?
Well, I always agree with anything Megan says. So, you know,
don't do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I understand that all three of us are residents of cities. You and I live in cities. But I want to say that Shine is just getting off the ground. We've been laying the groundwork for it for a long, long time, but it's just getting off the ground as an actual nonprofit. So the city has no track record. Nobody has any track record of being for it or against it or anything. I think Mayor Alorza was a housing court judge, and he knows more than your average mayor about housing issues. And he's also, or at least recently was, I'm not sure if he still is, but he works with the National Council of Mayors as the chair of their homelessness committee. And he has, national influence, which means we have a disproportionate influence if we can do creative things and encourage him as a mayor to share some creative ideas nationally. But you always have to say, as long as there's a homeless person, we failed. You know, we're not there yet. We're not there at all. And generally, as a culture, we think we're making progress when we provide for shelters. And I just don't think that any form of congregate living works very well. And my metaphor for that is junior highs. You know, why do we have big, huge junior highs when we know that developmentally some of the strong leaders in the group are still in their bully stage, and they're going to pick on kids. And the more you congregate junior high kids together, the more of a pack of bullies you get, and the more terrifying that pack of bullies can be to the ones they persecute. So that I see homeless folks as being on a bell curve like just anybody else in terms of their temperament, their morality, their sense of humor, any kind of characteristic, they're on a bell curve. There's people that are really funny, and there's people who aren't funny at all. There's people who have a really high sense of morality and people that don't have any sense of morality at all, and everything in between. And we can identify each person for where they're at and for their individual aptitudes. And like I say, we have these carpenters and people, you know, graduating from Amos House's carpentry program, who have been carpenters for 20 years, who have trained other carpenters, you know, people that are real assets. And we can build on those assets just within the homeless community themselves. But too often we paint everybody with that broad stereotypical brush, and we imagine the worst, and the media does some criminal things to the mentally ill population, you know, portraying them as particularly dangerous when, you know, the fact is they're particularly undangerous, non-dangerous, much less likely to encounter a threatening person who has actual paranoid schizophrenia as being someone who's criminal. But we criminalize mental illness and send so many people to jail. A vast proportion of people in jail are mentally ill, not particularly because they've done crimes. A lot of it's for nonviolent offenses, particularly drugs, which people are, it's a big topic, but people are self-medicating from, you know, issues they have in the way their brain is functioning. And we criminalize that. So there's so many issues on so many fronts, but we all have to get on board. You know, the academic community, the business community, the municipal communities. And we have a special concern to find lawyers and accountants that can manage a revolving fund and that can speak for people at zoning boards. Because one of the things I like about the potential shine is that it doesn't have to be focused on urban environments. It could be a rural person who has a bedroom available. It could be a suburban person who has a bedroom available. And the more we get away from aggregating the community and the more we have individual apartments, the more peace of mind everybody has. Because unfortunately it's the 1 or 2% of people that might be a criminal element that prey on the most vulnerable. When we release a mentally ill person from a mental hospital, what we're doing is we're potentially exposing them to a criminal element at a shelter. Like I say, 98% of the people in the shelter just are trying to get by. You know, if someone drops a dollar bill on the ground, they might return it to them. They might keep it in their pocket. You know, they're all over the map, but not all criminal by any means.
Right.
But we put very vulnerable people among that very small proportion of the criminal element. But the criminal element is able to disproportionately disrupt their lives because they're placed together. So if we could treat each person as an individual and disperse the housing and disperse the apartments and not aggregate it, it'd be a great help. I'll just say one other thing about that is that we're hoping to kind of encourage affinity relationships where it might be someone with a special heart for veterans that says, or a veteran themselves that says, I have an empty bedroom. Or it might be a member of the LGBTQ community that says, I have an empty bedroom for an LGBTQ person. Or a gardener having an extra bedroom for a gardener. Or a bicyclist having an extra bedroom for a bicyclist. Or a musician for a musician. So that we'd like to introduce the homeless as having, like, you know, gardener and homeless, experiencing homelessness, musician and also experiencing homelessness, so that, you know, the hyphen, it isn't homeless musician, it's musician who's homeless. And then just build more housing stock, because we somehow have this weird notion that people have to be very evolved people to live in an apartment. You know, for eons, people have lived in apartments and they're drinkers or they have other problems in their lives. And so there's people out here, out in the world, I believe, that will say, I understand that. I understand that someone's much more likely to get into recovery or whatever if they have an apartment. And I can supply a bedroom that has a separate entrance for someone that has issues in their lives. And we need to think more about compassion and love than we think about this kind of punitive idea that we're kind of mixed up and we say, well, I worked hard for what I got. I'm part of the meritocracy. That's great for people who worked hard for what they got and who are part of the meritocracy. But people kind of twist that around to say that anybody who's struggling deserves what they got. And that's just not true. It's not even remotely true. I was talking yesterday to a woman. She's in recovery. She helps other people. She's my hero, and I told her that, because she was kidnapped when she was 12 and entered the sex trafficking trade. And you know, it was just heartrending to hear her story. But people, you know, don't get the head starts in life that a lot of us got. So we think we earned our meritocracy, but we got a few head starts, and other people are struggling, you know, right out of the gate. They had just incredible, you know, persecutions and problems. So getting to know people personally and to hear their story and know where they come from as individuals, that's what we encourage at the breakfast. We literally have what we call a perpetual May breakfast. You could come any Sunday, just sit down, have a free breakfast, and talk to people there. You know, it's not income adjusted. You just come and make friends. And because we are so segregated, the housing segregated, education segregated, you have to make an intentional effort to cross the divide of that segregation. So the breakfast is part of that, volunteering and going out and being part of the groups meeting people at night and supporting people at night. It's all part of it.
Yeah, you can't draw circles around people. We're not going to move forward if we do that, that's for sure.
No, absolutely not. And I feel like so much of our policy propagates those divides. And I think that when it comes to the issue of homelessness, I feel like this where the focus should be, which is on helping people connect with the resources they need to have their lives look the way they want their lives to look, to meet their self-defined goals, gets twisted into invisibilization of what's the most expedient way for us to not see these folks in our communities because we don't like it, we think it's aesthetically displeasing, we think it's bad for our economic development. You know, you name the narrative. Sweep it under the rug. Exactly. And I feel like that's been a constant push-pull in various parts of Providence of certain particularly economic actors downtown, you know, having a vested interest in pushing poor people out of the downtown area. And a lot of that does occur through criminalization, criminalization of behavioral health, criminalization of poverty. And so that's definitely been an ongoing dialogue we've had with the mayor and with city government. Because I think that it requires a lot of sustained dialogue and a lot of willingness to sort of look below the surface of an issue such as the downtown smoking ban or such as the open container laws, these things that seem facially neutral until you really look at how they're enforced and against whom they're enforced. And they're not enforced against people who look like us, who are decently dressed white people. They're enforced against people who fit stereotypes about what it looks like to be homeless, what it looks like to be an immigrant, what it looks like to be LGBT. And these are the populations that are targeted by some of these laws. And I think that issues of criminalization and access to public space are very, very integrally linked with issues of homelessness and visible poverty.
No question. It's interesting you bring that up. I did have former Providence Mayor Joe Paolino in here just a few days ago, and of course brought up the smoking ban, which is obviously a garbage law that is just racially and economically motivated to quote unquote clean up, you know, Kennedy Plaza, you know, just in a lot of ways kind of a heartless law. So and I'm pleased that obviously the mayor Lorza is not enforcing that that law. But you know, I totally agree. You know, you go to watch you think somebody who is at RISD who walks across the street smoking a cigarette is going to get that ticket. Of course not. You know, it's obvious that there's factors here in Providence that are powerful factions, powerful people that are actively working against the interests of improving the situation here with respect to affordable housing and homelessness. Would you both agree with that? Factors in the private sector are kind of impacting in a negative way.
Absolutely.
I generally do, with the caveat that, you know, if we want decent schools, we have to have a decent tax base. Yep. We have to have buildings occupied. And I think, and if we want services for mentally ill, if we want police officers, all of it, we need a tax base. And so much of the tax base is taken up by nonprofit institutions that aren't paying city taxes, et cetera. So it's going to be a challenge all around. And I see people struggling and trying to be compassionate as they seek other interests, you know, and to some level it's been a failure, and there's been tactics that they've used that have been horribly offensive that you know, brought my friends to tears, you know, going around a park and filming people, like there might be sooner for their own kind of disheveled or not fully dressed in a certain way or whatever, and taking a film of that and lifting it up and, you know, labeling people as being a problem. When we don't even begin to have the services for mental illness or substance abuse that we need. And a statistic that's really jumped out at me was that there's 100% recidivism among the mentally ill who try to quit smoking. You know, that in the studies, nobody stops smoking, you know, for long-term. It's because for many who are mentally ill and deal with anxiety or they deal with disorganized thinking, well, a cigarette actually helps relieve anxiety and disorganized thinking. So it's actually an effective self-medication. It causes cancer, but for what they're trying to medicate, it's effective. So people with that extra burden in their life of, you know, not being able to stop smoking, we're really criminalizing just a biological reality. It's horrible.
And what rankles me is the disingenuousness of the conversation, right? Yeah. This ordinance was passed with the thinnest veneer of public health. And it's not really about public health. It's about criminalization. That's very clear, as you said. And just, I mean, the most patent example of that is when someone is cited, they're not given smoking cessation resources. They're not encouraged to connect with this doctor or given a way to access nicotine patches,
right, or
to be even to be referred to a Brown study. You know, you see these things on these signs on the buses, which is its own issue. But, you know, the point is that there's no actual focus on connecting the person with smoking cessation resources. The focus is on squeezing $50 out of a poor person. And prior to the city not enforcing the arrest warrant provision of the smoking ban, I was having clients held a full weekend in jail for smoking a tobacco cigarette. The most egregious example was I am working with a transgender woman who just started receiving gender-affirming care, taking hormones, and she stopped smoking because her provider told her that the treatment will work best if she's not smoking. So at the time that she was arrested on a warrant for smoking downtown, she had been quit for 4 months. She was picked up on a Friday afternoon, and she spent the entire weekend in jail.
Wait a second. So they're out there. Wait a second. So you're telling me they were out there, the police were out there on looking for, you know, didn't have an encounter with this person for another reason, and they just found her and picked her up and took her to jail on a warrant for not paying a fine for smoking a cigarette? Is that basically what we're talking?
And again, subsequently, the city has changed their practice on this. I just want to make sure that's clear. They are no longer issuing warrants for unpaid smoking tickets. But as of a few months ago, they absolutely were issuing warrants for unpaid smoking tickets, and they absolutely were bringing people in on them.
And in terms of kind of disregard of health, we know that homelessness itself is a cancer. It is something that leads to premature death. And it's a health problem. And that's why, again, Housing First is a medical treatment for something that brings about premature death, as well as all kinds of stress-related illnesses and every kind of being exposed to cold and all the things that can harm your bodily functions. It just really, you know, having that health kind of concern and compassion, it's not happening the way it needs to happen.
And the average age of death for someone who experiences homelessness in the U.S. today is 48 years old, which is egregious. It's more life expectancy loss than smoking by most studies. Of course, those things are, as you mentioned, not inseparable because a high percentage of people who experience homelessness do smoke.
And which is also a reaction to trauma. Mm-hmm. People who experience trauma have a harder time. You know, the nicotine fix is there, is kind of a crutch for coping with trauma. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, not at all. No, I highlight that number because I agree with it's shocking.
It's really shocking.
That's less than the life expectancy was 100 years ago. And you think of all the public health advances that have happened in the last 100 years that have essentially not touched the life expectancy of people who experience homelessness.
That might be 32 years of life that they miss. Mm-hmm. You know, if an average, you know, we're approaching 80 years old.
It's outrageous. And, you know, what these statistics verify is that the eye tests, the anecdotal evidence that you can get just from driving from one side of Providence to the other, you know, that is, you know, you can back it up and your gut instinct that we live in a multi-tiered society that even within the ranks of the poor and the ranks of the middle class, there's enormous division. We've seen a stereotype presented of what a homeless person is and what their life might be. We've seen it regurgitated time and time again by media outlets around here. And I think it's a disgrace. Well, I'm with you.
We've seen that defeating people's worst instincts and worst impulses can sell media time. And it's just we have to dig deep. And that's another segment of society that needs to look at what they're doing. And also not just keep selling the same story about as wonderful as it is, you know, people finding hats for people or yoga instruction for the homeless or flower arranging or, you know, there's wonderful things that feed the soul. But we're not necessarily addressing things on the hierarchy of needs until we create apartments. So I'd really love to see Boy Scout troops, Girl Scouts, you know, Sunday schools collecting nuts and bolts or pieces of lumber or drywall or, you know, something that's going to impact building a place where someone can lock the door at night and feel safe and go to sleep and not be sleep deprived and have a place to be that.
Yeah, the fundamental dignity that most people are offering their pets and, you know, their dogs a lot of times. You know what I mean? That enclosure to feel dignity and, you know, a sense of an ability to reset.
And that you have boundaries around you. That your person has a boundary and that it's respected with a door you can lock at night and feel.
What can people do? What can the average person listening to this right now, what can they do today? What can they do in reality to contribute? I know, obviously, getting materials, that's a great start. So on that sort of level of practicality, what can you do?
Yeah, I mean, this might sound like a frou-frou answer, but I truly believe that the first thing people can do is get proximate. You really need to give yourself the opportunity to have conversations with people who experience homelessness. So that can be, I'm offering the Sunday breakfast.
Yes, free that's, breakfast.
That's coming on outreach with us. We go out every night. Is it kosher to say my email on the radio?
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
My email is Megan, M-E-G-A-N, at thehouseofhopecdc.org. My phone number is 484-0234. You're always welcome to join us. We have folks who are out for the first time with us out almost every night. It's a beautiful way to hear directly from people about their experiences and coming from that. We've had the most beautiful organic projects. One of the, just a shout out to one group, a group of students from Moses Brown is Instead of doing a more traditional drive for hats and gloves, which, don't get me wrong, are valuable.
Right.
Instead,
I didn't mean to diss that.
Thank you, Jobline, whoever's coordinating that.
Absolutely.
You know, totally.
Absolutely. They've raised money to help people replace their vital documents so that they can apply for jobs and apply for housing. And we're going to train this group of students to do a couple of visits with folks in the community so that we can help people start getting IDs replaced.
That's
huge.
And
that came directly from them asking people themselves, what do you need? What is stopping you from getting where you want to be?
Thanks for being a part of this very important discussion. I'll have much more on this topic for you throughout the year right here on the Bartholomew Town Podcast. New episodes of the pod every Tuesday and Friday at bartholomewtown.com, ripodcast.com, or wherever you consume podcasts. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.